and a real pleasure for me to come and visit just for the evening, maybe briefer than I thought, because I thought I was going to be here an hour or so before I actually arrived, but that was mostly due to Highway 85 and Highway 280, which was amazingly crowded, but I guess expectable. So, and then when I pulled into School Street, I was, you know, hit with the memory of having been here before. But it was quite a while ago. Kokyo was saying, well, maybe it was when Catherine became the abbess, ascended the mountain seat here, and maybe that was it. But this street felt very familiar to me, except it was much brighter. It was sunlit the last time I was here. Thank goodness it's not sunlit. Thank goodness we have a little bit of rain anyway. And I see some familiar faces, so it's a pleasure to see you all, folks who I know, and those of you I don't know. I thought I'd start by speaking a little bit autobiographically, just to give you a little introduction as to who I am. Not really who I am, but a few things. So, my wife, Linda, and I have been living at Green Gulch Farm for 23 years. We moved there when our kids were 6 and 11. Some of you know our children who are now adults out there in the world doing stuff to our great joy. And I came to Zen Center in 1968. And I came as a result of the combination of my own seeking and the world, what the world gave me. So in Zen, we sometimes talk about how practice or way-seeking mind is like the chick inside the egg. And I don't know if this is literally true. I'm looking at Liz thinking that she knows whether this is literally true or not. But in the Zen way of understanding it, the mother pecks from the outside and the chick pecks from the inside. And together they break the shell and the chick can emerge. So this is our own. So I mentioned my own intention and what the world provided, more or less accidentally. Because I think that's an archetypal shape for all of us. And actually I say intention, but really what was behind the intention was my own suffering, my own dis-ease and confusion and feeling of not fitting in to the, in some ways fitting in, but in other ways not fitting in to the culture and the world I was born into. Eastern European Jewish culture, New York City, Queens. My son, the doctor, was what was on offer. And that didn't resonate with me whatsoever. So I very much appreciate the quotation from C.G. Jung, where he says that the right way to wholeness is made up of wrong turnings and fateful detours. And in September of 1968, on the New York side of the Lincoln Tunnel, I stuck out my thumb and took a 3,500-mile detour to San Francisco, where I wound up a few days later. And 2 weeks after that, I was living at Zen Center, which at that time in the city in San Francisco was not where it is now on Page Street, but was the old Sokoji on Bush Street. I lived across the street or around the block from there. So as you all know, Suzuki Roshi died December 4th, 1971. So I actually got a chance to practice with Suzuki Roshi for the last few years of his life. In a sense, when I look back on it, I wasn't close with him the way certain people really made a point of trying to be with him and learn from him. And due to my own youth and foolishness, I wasn't one of those people. But nevertheless, even just with the amount of contact that I did have with him, that's what really sealed my practice. At that time, I had a ponytail. And I was told, he didn't say this to me, but I was told that he said to somebody else, looking at me, he said, "I've got my eye on that ponytail." So for me, Suzuki Roshi was and continues to be really the his teaching and his way continue to for me to be the heart of my own understanding and practice and efforts, the engine or the gasoline in the engine of that effort on my part. And among the people who did spend time with him, I've had the feeling, particularly in recent years, that in a sense everyone had their own Suzuki Roshi, and that he meant different things to different people, or the emphasis was different. So for me, I feel, these very, in a sense, simple, fundamental human qualities, human virtues, particularly kindness and humility. That's, Suzuki Roshi is a big topic for me, a big thing, but those are very primary in my sense of him and in my sense of what practice has to do with, what Zen practice is about. Kindness and generosity and humility. What I want to speak about, we'll see how much and whether I actually get to the topic in the time allotted, because I do want to allow some time for your questions and some interaction. But what I want to speak about is teaching, not from Suzuki Roshi specifically, but from Dogen Zenji, Eihei Dogen. And many of you know, I'm sure, most of you know, Dogen was a Japanese Zen master who lived in the first half of the 13th century. And Dogen, in our school, in our family way that we have, Dogen is a very, very important figure. The lineage, which is an important aspect of our practice, the lineage and the transmission from Suzuki Roshi goes back and back to his teacher and 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 his teacher, and his teacher directly back to Dogen. So the lineage that Kokyo has through Reb and that I have through Mel goes directly back to Dogen. So he's like great, 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 great grandfather, you know, more greats, but, you know, he's like major figure in our way of practice. And Suzuki Roshi, right behind Suzuki Roshi is Dogen. Suzuki Roshi often referred to Dogen specifically. Dogen Zenji said this, and this was the way Dogen Zenji understood it, etc., etc. Zenji just means Zen teacher, Zen master. And even when he wasn't specifically referring to Dogen, now when I read Suzuki Roshi's words, it's Dogen all over. You know, it's like Dogen is behind him. So what I want to speak about is just a few lines from one of Dogen's works. And in San Francisco, so I live at Green Gulch Farm. I have the great good fortune to live at Green Gulch Farm in that practice environment. But unusually, even though I live at Green Gulch Farm, I don't work full-time at Green Gulch. Most of the people who live there ongoingly are there 24/7, so to speak. When you were there, Kokyo, that was the case, right? You lived there in Shoho, too. So I live at Green Gulch, but I work as a psychotherapist in San Francisco. And about 4 years ago, I decided, after a decade or two of consideration, I decided to begin a Zen group, a small Zen sitting group, near my workplace. So we rent, so the Presidio Hill Zen group is the group that I'm started. And we rent a room, a very nice room, actually about the size of this room, in a church in San Francisco, not far from my office. And over a number of years, and it's gotten to be a group, you know, with strong core of practitioners, a small group, just 10 or 15 people usually, and it's just once a week, Thursday evenings. So, and we've mostly been studying over the years, we've mostly been studying very, very slowly, not always so, Suzuki Roshi's, the collection of Suzuki Roshi's talks, not always so. It's taken us years just to get through about 10 of them so far, because we just do it paragraph by paragraph and line by line, and word by word, and so on. But occasionally, I decided it would be nice occasionally, because most of the people are rather new, to do occasional Zazen instruction. And even though all of the people there received Zazen instruction, and I'm sure that all of you have received Zazen instruction and maybe offer Zazen instruction to others. Nevertheless, it felt like that was a good thing to do to remind those of us who have received Zazen instruction what it is, and for those who haven't to provide that kind of context. Not really information, more like the practice sense of what Zazen is about. So that's what I'm going to do this evening a little bit with Dogen's essay on the practice of Zazen. That essay is called the Fukan Zazen Gi. Fu means universal or widely applicable. Fukan. Kan means like recommendations or exhortations or admonishments or like that. Fukan Zazen, sitting Zen, Gi, principle. So altogether, Fukan Zazen Gi in English is translated as the Kan. What is Kan again? I just said it. Thank you. Universal recommendation of the principles of Zazen. Universally recommended principles of Zazen. That's what we would call it in English. Dogen, so he lived in the first half of the 13th century. Brilliant, prolific, deep understanding. I kind of think of him as, you know, like Bach, like Mozart. People beyond the ken of us mere mortals, you know, people who like, oh my God, you know. So he wrote it when he was like 25, the Fukan Zazen Gi, which is just astounding. So he was practicing and deeply immersed in Buddhist teaching as a teenager and into his 20s, but felt dissatisfied. It wasn't quite right. So he went to China, which was like the seat of ancient wisdom for Japanese people at that time. He went to China, and when he returned in 1227, one of the very first things that he wrote, and he wrote a great deal, many, many works, but one of the very first things that he wrote is the Fukan Zazen Gi, because he wanted to convey the essential practice of Zen that he felt he had received when he was in China. And that's what the Fukan Zazen Gi is. So it's just a short thing. It's just a, you know, you may have seen it, you may have read it, you may have chanted it here at Santa Cruz Zen Center. It's just a few pages long, but it's a very deep and brilliant and, in a sense, even though brief, very comprehensive sense of what practice is, what Zazen practice is. And so saying that, it's necessary to say, and I think important to say, because again, this is what I'm about to say is it was a very important aspect of Suzuki Roshi's teaching. So we say Zazen, and I'm going to speak about Zazen and the practice of Zazen, but we understand, and Suzuki Roshi emphasized, Zazen and everyday life as not separate. So we talk about Zazen practice and what we do or don't do in Zazen practice, but we also talk about Zazen mind. Zazen mind is the mind, heart, emotional, psychological, intellectual life that we cultivate in the world. And unless we, it's applied, you know, it's like applied zazen, you know, applied to our karmic life. And unless we do that, then we're in danger of having some special fancy thing that we do when we're, you know, sitting and facing a wall, instead of something that actually permeates our life. And Suzuki Roshi's emphasis was very much on that sense of, this teaching is for our life, for the life we have, not for somebody else's life, not for some life of some enlightened person when you get enlightened, not for some life of people who lived in 13th century Japan, but the actual life that we have now. That's what it's for. That's its, you might say, that's its function. So I'll speak about Zazen, but we need to keep in mind Zazen mind, the wide applicability of it. And there, so the Fukan Zazengi, the universal recommendations of the principles of Zazen, a wonderful kind of combination, it's very classical, very, very archetypal, or it's just like Dogen, the way that he writes about things, you know, which is this combination of, well, in the Fukan Zazengi, there's this combination of deep philosophical teaching about Zazen and the function of Zazen and what it's about, in combination with very, very, very practical, down-to-earth kinds of things, like put your left foot on your right thigh and your right foot on your left thigh, put this here, this should be in line with this, this should be in line with that, etc. You know, just really just kind of rudimentary, you know. But that's very characteristic of Dogen, is this kind of infusing deep meaning in our rudimentary, simple activities, like Zazen, like cooking, you know, another famous work of his about the work and the life of a head cook. So it's this wonderful combination of these things, and he begins, I want to get to a certain point, but I'll just mention a couple of things at the beginning of it. He begins with this kind of deep philosophical questioning. Well, why practice Zazen? What is it about? Which, for those of you familiar with it, you probably know that this was really a very essential question that he carried for many years from when he was a child. His mother died, I think, when he was 7 years old. And that set him off in a very seeking, what's it all about and what's happening? What's important? So similarly about Zazen, he begins by talking about, well, what's the purpose of it? Why sit Zazen? And then he speaks about revered historical instances. He speaks about Shakyamuni Buddha, and he speaks about Bodhidharma and how sitting was so important for them. And then he begins to narrow things down from there and says that Zazen is, our practice is not an intellectual exercise. It's not about the intellect. It's about something much deeper and wider than our mind. And it's internal. We take a backward step and turn the light inward. Just that is enough. You know, just that is enough for us, I feel. For us who lead very busy lives and are running around all the time and driving on freeways, getting stuck in traffic, having fights with people. No, we don't necessarily have fights, but anyway, interactions with others, you know. That's enough. Take a backward step and turn the light inward. There are certain political figures who we might even think of that we could recommend that to, who are tentatively running for president in the primaries. Take a backward step and turn the light inward, rather than what we usually do, which is we turn the light out onto things and people and move this here and I want that and you do that and how come that's happening and I don't like that. And that's our usual way. So our Zazen way and our way of Zazen mind is different than that, is backward, not aggressive, not coercive. Take a backward step and turn the light inward. The next thing he says is very important for us, which is that Zazen is a matter of right now. Our practice is something we do now. This has to do with, in the traditional way of understanding it, I won't go into detail about this, but the traditional way of understanding it is practice and realization are not two separate things. So we don't practice in order to get somewhere. It's not instrumental in that way. It's not instrumental. That's what I mean. But it's not a means to get to an end. It's the end and the means together. So he says various things like that. I'm going to move on because this is the part that I want to get to. These lines. I'm almost at the end of my time, but I have a lot to say about him, but just a little bit. So he said all of those things. Then he says, cast aside all involvements. Cease all affairs. Do not think good or bad. Do not administer pros and cons. Cease all the movements of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thoughts and views. That's what I wanted to get to, those four sentences. I'll say them again just to help us get in the mood. Cast aside all involvements and cease all affairs. Do not think good or bad. Do not administer pros and cons. Cease all the movements of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thoughts and views. What I had hoped to talk about, which I actually may not get to, or one of the things I had hoped to speak about, is kind of there's, I believe, I feel, two ways of understanding what Dogen is saying here. Let me just start with the first, which is the more obvious, the more straightforward way. So I'm not sure what it is in the original Japanese, but in English, like I just quoted, I thought the word was case or declension, but apparently the word is mood. The mood is imperative. You know, like in grammar, you know, you have the declarative and the interrogative and so on. This is imperative. Do this, don't do that, mostly don't do. Don't do that, don't do that, and don't do that, you know. Cease all affairs. Oh, so, hey, I think what he's saying is stop doing what we usually spend all of our time doing. Maybe he didn't cover that field entirely, but, you know, his examples are pretty, cover a good amount of the field, right? you know, our involvements and our affairs, we all know about those, thinking good or bad. Oh yeah, I like him, I don't like her, this is good, I like chocolate, I don't like vanilla, etc., etc. Administering pros and cons. Well, I could do this, but, you know, on the other hand, maybe it's better if I do that. Anyway, I think he talks about a lot of them, but I thought it would be interesting, and I offer as a practice for you to add your own. Add your own admonitions, your own recommendations. So I've added everything that Dogen says, and then I've also added, don't review the past or anticipate the future. Oh, and the reason I added it is because I even had a more specific version. Don't review really good movies and TV programs that you have watched in the past. Don't review the plot of them step by step by step by step. And don't anticipate the future. Particularly, don't anticipate what it is that you're going to say to Joe or Mary or Suzanne or Tom tomorrow, especially in the light of what they said to you yesterday, and, you know, really clarify things for them. Don't do those things. That's my own. But you may have your own too. Those are my own because they're well suited for often what I get caught up in. So, so what's behind that recommendation, that teaching, that admonition is that usually our life is completely caught up in exactly those kinds of things. That's called karmic life. Karmic consciousness. Karma means the result of our limited views, the result of limitations. Like I said earlier, I was born and raised in New York City, Eastern European Jews. I wasn't born in Australia in the 17th century or someplace else, some other time. That's karma. And it's all very, very, the way karma works is that it's very specific. It's exactly the way it is. The clothes that you're wearing now are exactly because of a million different, infinite number really, of factors that led to your wearing the clothes that you're wearing now, or me wearing the clothes that I'm wearing now, or the number of hairs, fewer than they used to be, but the number of hairs on my head and on your head. It's an exact number. You haven't counted them, I haven't counted them, but it is very, very precise. And it's very precise because of infinite causation. That's the way infinite causation works. It creates this very precise kind of thing. So that's just the way life is. That's not something we can or need to do anything about. We have to take care of our karma. But what can be additional, or what can be, as Suzuki Roshi used to say, extra. We don't need to add anything extra. The extra part is when we're caught in our karma, when we're stuck in our karma. So Zazen is an opportunity to experience non-stuckness, non-caughtness. That's a way of saying it negatively, what it non-caughtness and non-stuckness. To say it positively, Shohaku Okamura, a contemporary Zen teacher, mentioned this metaphor to me, which I think is really nice, which is like we're like, I think it's a traditional Zen metaphor, we're like a frog at the bottom of a well. A frog at the bottom of a well looks up to the sky and sees a circle of blue, right? And they think, that frog thinks, oh, that's the sky. It's a circle of blue. That's the way karma is. That's the way all of us see the world, like a circle of blue. We have to. You know how they say the spectrum of hearing is this big, but humans only have this much of it, you know, or maybe this much of it, you know. That's human karma. It's limited. It's limited. The great gift of practice and of Zazen that Dogen opens for us and that Suzuki Roshi opens for us is that ain't the whole picture. That's all true. And it's very necessary for us to take care of our karma. But simultaneous, laminated to our karmic life is completely non-karmic life. Laminated to our stuck world and our limited view is the possibility, the opportunity to experience unlimited life. Which is, this is not like we have to go somewhere to do it. This is the way it is. You know, it's that way. But we manage, because we're so busy with our karma, we're so busy with our limitations, we manage not to see the unlimited quality of things. So Dogen gives us this instruction, casting aside our involvement, ceasing our affairs, not thinking good or bad. He's just saying, take the opportunity, this backward step, to open your mind. It's not really open your mind. That sounds too like something you got to do. It's really to allow the openness of, allow yourself to know the openness of your mind. More like that. That openness is already there. That big mind is already there. It's not something we have to create or figure out how to make happen. It's just more like reveal. Well, I have a number of other things to say, but I will stop at that point. Maybe just one more thing. So, in another work of Dogen, he says, here is the way, no, he says, here is the place, here the way unfolds. And you might think, well, here, where is that here? And even though I've only quoted that sentence from this other work of Dogen's, I think it's the Genjo Koan, the rest of the Genjo Koan doesn't give you, you wouldn't know more about where the here is if you read the entire thing. That's because here is here. He really meant here. He really meant here. Wherever we are, wherever you are, wherever I am, here. There's always a here, right? We've always got a here. That's the here he was referring to. Here is the place. Here the way unfolds. Not something else, not someplace else, not somewhere else. Not some dusty realm of other lands. Not some elevated state that you need to get to. Here the way unfolds. Here it is. That's resonant with this sense of here's the opportunity for big mind. For us to participate, experience big mind. And it's from that, really, that all of the virtues that we speak about come. That's where kindness and humility come from. That's where, the six paramitas, that's where generosity and morality and patience and the other paramitas come from. From that liberated place. Okay, I will stop now and just see if you have any comments or questions about what I've been speaking about or about anything else is fine with me. Yes.
Thank you. Would it be fair to say about the here that it's a space of intimacy and immediacy?
Yes.
In which we are receptive to what comes.
Yes, very much so. Mm-hmm. And I think that receptivity resonates with the backward step. And I'll just throw in a little piece here, which different than what I've been talking about, which is my own feeling is that in this way, archetypally, I associate receptivity with the feminine. And I feel that our practice, our Zen practice, has a not a feminine quality. I'm going to get in trouble talking this way. this is a very important part of our life, and this reception, rather than, it's like that thing of turning the light inward to illuminate the self rather than going out. And I think this is extremely important for us destroyers of the planet and non-receptive doers. Very important for us in particular. And the quality is of intimacy, very much. To be intimate with our own karmic life and to be intimate with our deeper self as well.
Would the stepping back allow that or encourage that?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So that's something we often get caught in Zazen. Oh, Dogen says, cast aside all involvements. Well, I better do that. I'm going to do that and not do that, and then I'm going to do everything right, and then good things will result. That's very, it's very sincere and understandable. But it doesn't exactly work that way. We discover after a while, that kind of doing, I'm going to make this happen, I'm going to follow the rules, turns out to be the same as all the other stuff that we do. Even though it's highly elevated spiritual material that we're doing. So it's a very deep practice. It's very deep. You keep going. You have to keep going. Doesn't end somewhere. Something else? Yes.
A lot of the features of karma that you mentioned seem kind of biological to me, like the hairs on the head and time and place of birth and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I get that, and it seems like sort of impossible to transcend, you know? Ultimately, you don't.
Yes, I know.
Through a body, like,
yes. Right.
But at the same time, you know, sometimes in Sishin or a really good moment or whatever, I just can be there and hear everything and that sort of thing. And I think that's all there is, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not sure if there's more that you're talking about in terms of, like, access to that other thing that's not karmically bound.
Good. I appreciate what you're saying, because again, we can get stuck in an idea that there's something that's not karmically bound. There is only our karmic life. There is, or I should say, there is only one life. There is only our life. From one perspective, it can be very grabby and stuck and caught. From another perspective, it can be very open. And when it's open, it's different than when it's stuck. Excuse me?
I definitely see that.
Yeah.
I thought maybe you were talking about something else, though, with the frog metaphor. I mean, that there's access to something else besides our little piece of sky.
It's when you're a frog and you realize that the sky is, that you see the disk, and it makes sense that you see the disk, but that there's more than the disk. And I dare say that we can experience that there's more than the disc. It's an experience. Maybe like the experience you're talking about that you have sometimes. But as soon as you begin to point to it and measure it and say, oh, well, what about that experience? And gee, was this that experience? Then it's immediately not that experience anymore, because we immediately bring it into our karmic realm of pros and cons and likes and dislikes and, you know, so on. So it's there all the time, but as soon as you talk about it, you're wrong. As soon as you limit it, you're wrong. And we limit it immediately by recognizing it. As soon as we recognize it, well, then we've lost it. So it's a paradoxical kind of a thing. Tricky to talk about. Yes, Stan.
I don't know if you probably delighted as much as I did in Pope Francis and how he seemed to be able just to respond to the moment so lovingly and spontaneously and humbly as well. I was really just moved. He, to me, just in the last week or so, is just a living example of what one being can be and do.
I agree. I was very moved, and I'm very thankful that that some world figure,
yes,
is actually the Dalai Lama also,
yes,
but he's not as popular as the Pope. He's not in the headlines as much as the Pope. So, wonderful. But that, you know, we call it Catholicism, we call it Buddhism, it's from the same place. There's only one place that can come from. And we can call that big mind, we can call that love, we can call that caritas, whatever we call it, that's where it's coming from. And it's something different than our usual constricted way. Maybe we should have one more question and then end. Yes. Yes.
How we universally go wandering from where we are, and it's so universally helpful to be able to be in it without maybe capturing everything in that story or constantly reworking the story.
What's that?
Takes a lot of reminders.
Yeah. Encouragement. Yeah. I feel like Zen practice has less to do with instruction, like do this, then do this, then do this. It's more like you throw somebody in the end of the pool and you say, come on, you can swim, you know, come on, you can do it. I believe in you. It's a little bit more like that. Encouragement. Okay, well, thank you very much.